Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Wednesday, June 3rd, 2020. This is Section A, the front page. This article is entitled "Midlander Leads Protest Event to Talk About Racial Injustice" by J.C. Lewis. A recent college graduate led a protest Tuesday afternoon to talk about George Floyd and the racial injustice that black people have experienced for many decades. The event, organized by Latricia Smith, began at 2 p.m. outside the Midland County Courthouse and continued through downtown Midland along Big Spring Street. The protest was initially planned for 6 p.m., but she moved it to start at 2 p.m., hoping that the courthouse would still be open. Officials announced Monday night that the courthouse and city hall would be closed Tuesday because of the expected protests. There was a second protest at 6 p.m. "We're here to try to promote and advocate for Black Lives Matter," she said. Smith said she planned the protests on Tuesday after the Sunday protest because she saw a lot of news and pictures circulating of people waving Trump and Confederate flags. I felt like a lot of the news and pictures I've seen circulating the web involved Trump and Confederate flags, and it ruled out what we were really here for," Smith said. "I would like to have Black Lives Matter more of the picture." She said this was the first protest she has ever organized. It remained peaceful. "Our main message would be that although all lives are equal, Black lives matter too," she said. "We aren't trying to start a riot or any more violence. We're just trying to get our message across. We are people too, and we're human, and we deserve equality around the whole nation. And we should not be killed because of the color of our skin. Smith, who has lived in Midland since the sixth grade, recently graduated from Oklahoma State University. She said that since she returned to Midland, she has seen about half of Midland supporting and half of Midland against the movement. "For the most part, we are paying attention to the people who are with us and standing with us today," Smith said. "We are blocking out all the hatred and negativity that they have to say about our movement." She said the group will begin telling protesters the link so they can register to vote. "That would be a good start to help promote change in the justice system," she said. She said she doesn't want her little brothers to grow up being afraid because of the color of their skin. "I want to make a change before they grow up and have to deal with the things we are facing today, which should have been dealt with long ago," Smith said. She said it's important to unite as a nation and come together to find a solution going forward. The peaceful protest continued Tuesday evening as demonstrators marched through downtown chanting "Black Lives Matter" and "I Can't Breathe." They began outside the Midland County Courthouse at 6 p.m. before walking down Main Street, Wall Street, and Big Spring Street. About 30 protesters participated. Demonstrators stayed on the sidewalks and did not block traffic, as some did Sunday night. Tuesday night's protest appeared more organized than the one on Sunday night, as most people wore face masks and several passed out water bottles. There was no police presence at Tuesday night's demonstration. This is a statement from former President George W. Bush on the death of George Floyd. "Laura and I are anguished by the brutal suffocation of George Floyd and disturbed by the injustice and fear that suffocate our country. Yet we have resisted the urge to speak out because this is not the time for us to lecture. It is time for us to listen. It is time for America to examine our tragic failures, and as we do, we will also see some of our redeeming strengths. It remains a shocking failure that many African Americans, especially young African American men, are harassed and threatened in their own country. It is a strength when protesters, protected by responsible law enforcement, march for a better future. This tragedy, and a long series of similar tragedies, raises a long overdue question. How do we end systemic racism in our society? The only way to see ourselves in a true light is to listen to the voices of so many who are hurting and grieving. Those who set out to silence those voices do not understand the meaning of America or how it becomes a better place. America's greatest challenge has long been to unite people of very different backgrounds into a single nation of justice and opportunity. The doctrine and habits of racial superiority, which once nearly split our country, still threaten our union. The answers to American problems are found by living up to American ideals, to the fundamental truth that all human beings are created equal and endowed by God with certain rights. We have often underestimated how radical that quest really is, and how our cherished principles challenge systems of intended or assumed injustice. The heroes of America, from Frederick Douglass to Harriet Tubman to Abraham Lincoln to Martin Luther King Jr., are heroes of unity. Their call has never been for the faint-hearted. They often revealed the nation's disturbing bigotry and exploitation, stains on our character sometimes difficult for the American majority to examine. We can only see the reality of America's need by seeing it through the eyes of the threatened, oppressed, and disenfranchised. That is exactly where we now stand. Many doubt the justice of our country, and with good reason. Black people see the repeated violation of their rights without an urgent and adequate response from American institutions. We know that lasting peace will only come by peaceful means. Looting is not liberation, and destruction is not progress. But we also know that lasting peace in our communities requires truly equal justice. The rule of law ultimately depends on the fairness and legitimacy of the legal system, and achieving justice for all is the duty of all. This will require a consistent, courageous, and creative effort. We serve our neighbors best when we try to understand their experience. We love our neighbors as ourselves when we treat them as equals in both protection and compassion. There is a better way, the way of empathy and shared commitment and bold action and a peace rooted in justice. I am confident that together Americans will choose the better way. The headline reads, Pro-Petro to invoke idled frack fleet fees on Pioneer Natural Resources, by Sergio Ciampa, Houston Chronicle. Midland Oilfield Service Company Pro-Petro plans to exercise a contract clause that obliges Irving Oil Company, Pioneer Natural Resources, to pay millions of dollars in fees for idling hydraulic fracturing fleets in the Permian Basin. ProPetro notified investors about the plan in a late Monday afternoon filing with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. The Midland-based service company bought Pioneer's hydraulic fracturing and coil tubing fleets for $110 million in a November 18th deal. Along with the sale, Pioneer entered into a 10-year service agreement with ProPetro, where the Irving Oil Company agreed to use its former fleets to continue developing oil wells in the Permian Basin. The deal, however, also included a clause where Pioneer agreed to pay idle fleet fees to ProPetro. ProPetro currently has 8 fleets currently committing to Pioneer, but expects to receive between $32 and $36 million in idle fees during the second quarter and another $12 million to $18 million spread out during the third and fourth quarters. During times when there is a significant reduction in overall demand for our services, the idle fees could represent a material portion of our revenues, the company's general counsel Mark Howell wrote in the SEC filing. The fees may prove to be a lifeline for ProPetro, which is facing reduced demand for its services due to record low oil prices and the coronavirus pandemic, which have companies such as Pioneer cutting their budgets and scaling back their activity in the oil fields. ProPetro also reported Monday a $7.8 million loss, a large swing from the $69.8 million profit during the first quarter of 2019. The company's first quarter revenue of $395 million was a 28% drop compared to $546 million 1 year prior. In addition to facing an investor's lawsuit, ProPetro has also laid off more than 1,400 employees since March, public filings show. Unfortunately, deteriorating market conditions resulted in a necessary reduction to our workforce, and we are grateful to all of our impacted team members for their hard work and dedication in serving our customers over the years, ProPetro CEO Philip Gobe said in a statement. While we found it prudent to make these reductions, we have retained the capacity to deliver efficient and safe services while protecting our ability to respond to a market that we expect to eventually improve. This article is entitled "Mummers Cancel Season Amid Virus" from Staff Reports. The Board of Summer Mummers announced Tuesday that it is canceling the annual event, a fundraiser for Midland Community Theater, because of restrictions posed by coronavirus. Summer Mummers 2020 show, Bootlegging Booberie in the Basin, was slated to open July 10th and continue through September 12th. But because of current CDC limitations in regards to COVID-19, and because the state hasn't yet issued reopening measures for live performances, the board decided that it was in the best interest of the community not to hold the event this year, according to a press release from MCT. It is with profound sadness that the Board of Summer Mummers must postpone plans for our annual event at the Yucca Theater, the board said in a statement. We had hoped to entertain you this summer, but the governor has not released reopening guidelines for live performances, and it is unforeseen when he will do so and or at what capacity. Summer Mummers has been a tradition in Midland since 1949. More than 100 volunteers come together Friday and Saturday evenings, July through September, at the Yucca Theater in downtown Midland to raise money through performances of a melodrama and oleo acts, popcorn and alcohol sales and raffle drawings. The volunteers raised more than $740,000 last year, with 30 performances over 14 weeks, according to the release. The group is pursuing other fundraising options that possibly could take place in July and August. Those who have already purchased tickets or made reservations will be contacted by the MCT box office. For more information, call 570-4111. This article is entitled, Members of Midland County Sheriff's Office, Midland Police Department were composed, respectful during protest, by Lisa Tankersley, Midland County Sheriff's Office. As many of you know, I am a mental health consumer advocate, which means I advocate for people like myself who have, do, or will need mental health support. I do segments on one of the local TV stations educating our community regarding mental health services. What you don't know is that I also work with our Sheriff's Department Mental Health Task Force as an advocate consultant. I am not an officer and am no way affiliated with the legal system, city, or county. I am a member of our community who advocates for the needs of people in our community. Our sheriff brought me on because he and the department truly value the people of this community and want to work to serve the community to the best of their ability. I see this in action on a daily basis. I saw it in action on Sunday at the mall in Midland. I went as a civilian without the knowledge of either the sheriff's office or the police department. As a mental health consumer advocate, I wanted to see how law enforcement handled the anxieties, fear, and anger that is being felt in our community. This is what I can tell you. I was moved to tears watching law enforcement from both the Sheriff's Department and Midland Police Department. As the crowd vented their frustration and pain, the men and women of these two departments stood composed and behaved with the utmost respect. I watched the officers being screamed at inches away from their faces, called names, told to eat feces, and pushed, and never once did I see them lose composure. When the crowds became angrier, the officers still did not engage. They continued to keep our community safe while maintaining composure and treating the protesters with respect. It was truly awe-inspiring. Monday morning, these same men and women were at work. I watched as they comforted parents whose children had been struggling. I watched as they saved a young girl when the world became too much. I watched as they called to check in on people struggling in our community, not as an officer, but as human beings showing concern for their fellow man. I watched them spend their day focusing on taking care of and striving to do their best for our community. So if you choose to protest, which is everyone's right, please do so knowing that there are good men and women in those uniforms who choose to go to work every day and protect and serve honorably. Lisa Tankersley is a mental health advocate consultant with Midland County Sheriff's Office and is on the advisory committee with Permia Care. This article is entitled City, Midland Medical Lodge resident is 13th COVID-19 death. Five new cases are confirmed, bringing total to 137. From staff reports. Midland County, the City of Midland, and Midland Health confirmed on Tuesday Midland County's 13th COVID-19 related death. The patient, a male in his 90s, died Monday at Midland Medical Lodge, where he was a resident, according to a press release from the city's spokeswoman. He is the 10th Medical Lodge resident to have died because of coronavirus, according to information from the city. Five new cases. Meanwhile, the Midland Health Department is conducting its investigation on five new confirmed cases of coronavirus in Midland County, bringing the overall case count to 137. The 133rd confirmed case is a female in her 60s who was tested by Midland Health. She is currently self-isolating at home. The source of exposure is contact to a known case. The woman is a non-clinical employee at Midland Health and last worked on May 27th. Employee Health is following up and monitoring employees with known contact. The 134th confirmed case is a female in her 30s who was tested by Midland Health. She is currently self-isolating at home. The source of exposure is contact to a known case. The 135th confirmed case is a male child, 0 to 9, who was tested by a private provider. He is currently self-isolating at home. The source of exposure is contact to a known case. The 136th confirmed case is a female adolescent, 10 to 19, who was tested by a private provider. She is self-isolating at home. The source of exposure is contact to a known case. The 137th confirmed case is a male adolescent, 10 to 19, who was tested by a private provider. He is currently self-isolating at home. The source of exposure is contact to a known case. With Tuesday's confirmed cases, five children and nine adolescents have tested positive for the virus. This article is entitled, Ector County Reports Six New Coronavirus Cases, from staff reports. Ector County reported six more cases of coronavirus Tuesday, making the total 167. Ector County reported nine probable cases at this time, according to ECHD website. ECHD reported that 119 people have recovered. There have been 2,550 tests taken, with 2,252 negative results and 131 pending results. ECHD has contacted 1,859 people during contact tracing. This article is entitled Crane County Reports Three More Deaths at Nursing Home, from staff reports. Crane County has reported three more coronavirus deaths of residents at Focus Care Center at Crane, according to a press release. Five residents at Focus Care Center at Crane have died from coronavirus. The county reported two more cases Monday in connection with the Focused Care Center. Crane County officials are working with the Texas Health and Human Services and the Department of State Health Services to help contain the spread of the virus, according to the release. Crane County has 23 positive cases, according to the Texas Department of Health and Human Services coronavirus tracker.
Hello, this is April reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Tuesday, June 2, 2020. Food distribution. Members of the Gathering Church teamed up with Permian Basin Oilfield and Energy Ministry Saturday to distribute 100 pantry boxes from the West Texas Food Bank, filled with extra donated fresh fruit. Items for baby were available for parents who needed them. Vet Center to host blood drive. Midland Vet Center is partnering with Vitalant to host a blood drive 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Wednesday at 4400 North Midland Drive, Suite 540. Potential donors can make an appointment at www.vitalant.org or by calling 697-8222. This is part of a nationwide effort by the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs to respond to the ongoing need for blood during the coronavirus pandemic, according to a press release from the center. Basin PBS to honor graduates. Basin PBS is airing Valedictorians in the Basin 7 p.m. Thursday. This special program, which will honor area schools, class of 2020, will feature valedictorians' speeches and other seniors' messages, according to a press release from the station. Districts and schools are Ector County ISD, Midland ISD, Greenwood ISD, Trinity School, Midland Christian School, Premier High School, and Midland Classical Academy. Sponsors are RID ID and HEB. Wonder Girls Summer Camp will be online. Crisis Center of West Texas is taking its fourth annual Wonder Girls Summer Camp online for Permian Basin girls who will be entering 5th through 8th grade. CCWTX will release a set of activities every Wednesday in July. Participants can complete the activities on their own schedule. The center has limited supplies and t-shirts to distribute to Permian Basin girls, according to a press release from the center. Supplies may be picked up on June 29. Time has not been set. To apply, go to bit.ly/WG2020-apply. Deadline is 6 p.m. June 19. Anyone who would like to donate so CCWTX can purchase extra supplies can do so at bit.ly/WG2020-donate. For more information, contact Elizabeth Texiera, Prevention Services Director, at elizabeth@ccwtx.org or 333-2527. MISD serves summer meals. Midland ISD summer meal schedule is in effect. Breakfast and lunch meals will be available for grab and go 10:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. Monday through Friday at 11 locations, according to a press release from the district. Meals are available for any child 18 or under or those who receive services from school. The locations are Bonham, Bowie, Bunch, Burnett, Dizavala, Rusk, Santa Rita, South, and Yarborough Elementary Schools, Fire Station No. 4, and Twin Oaks Mobile Home Park. MISD has served more than 405,000 meals during the COVID-19-related closure of schools. Victoria Beck, Director of Child Nutrition Services, said, "Daily menus are available at MidlandISD.net under Child Nutrition Services." Today in history. Today's Tuesday, June 2, the 154th day of 2020. There are 212 days left in the year. Today's highlight. On June 2, 1941, baseball's Iron Horse, Lou Gehrig, died in New York of a degenerative disease, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. He was 37. On this date, in 1897, Mark Twain was quoted by the New York Journal as saying from London that the report of my death was an exaggeration. Twain was responding to a report in the New York Herald that he was grievously ill and possibly dying. In 1966, U.S. space probe Surveyor 1 landed on the moon and began transmitting detailed photographs of the lunar surface. In 1976, Arizona Republic investigative reporter Don Bowles was mortally wounded by a bomb planted underneath his car. He died 11 days later. Prosecutors believed Bowles was targeted because he had written stories that upset a liquor wholesaler. Three men were convicted of the killing. In 1995, a U.S. Air Force F-16C was shot down by a Bosnian Serb surface-to-air missile while on a NATO air patrol in northern Bosnia. The pilot, Captain Scott F. O'Grady, was rescued by U.S. Marines 6 days later. Source, AP.
This is the opinion page. This column is entitled, "Police Need to Meet Rioters with Overwhelming Force," by Rich Lowry, King Features Syndicate. Restoring order to America's cities isn't a complicated proposition. All it requires is resources and determination, and a firm rejection of the long-standing progressive fallacy that an overwhelming police presence is provocative and escalatory and must be avoided. As has been established across decades of civil disturbances, it is police passivity that emboldens the mob. When the cops stand by or don't show up, or even worse, run away, it is a permission slip for destruction. They might as well spray paint bricks and hammers for the supplies. They might as well supply the spray paint, bricks, and hammers for the crowds and beckon them into the local Target or Nike store to take whatever they want. Out of control looting is almost always a failure of municipal resolve or police tactics, and we have seen plenty of just such cowardice and foolishness over the past several days, most notably in Minneapolis, ground zero for this spasm of urban disorder. In a display of sloppy, wishful thinking at the worst possible time, the city's leaders decided last week to vacate the 3rd Police Precinct. Mayor Jacob Fry explained that they believed this would be a way to both help de-escalate and prevent hand-to-hand combat. Instead, it allowed for a major escalation as protesters gleefully torched the police building in the worst possible symbol of official abdication of this crisis so far. During the first couple of nights of violence, Minneapolis barely managed to arrest anyone. For his part, Governor Tim Walz of Minnesota helped to mobilize the National Guard lest he seem oppressive. Apparently unaware that his target audience wasn't in a social justice seminar at Oberlin College. But provocateurs and nihilists who were going to take every inch they were given and make it a mile of broken glass and looted goods. President Donald Trump has a steady fount of inflammatory and crude statements over the last week. But when he blasted the, quote, total lack of leadership, unquote, in Minneapolis, he wasn't wrong. All state and municipal leaders need to know about controlling riots is obvious from a cursory review of the history. Consider the worst disturbance in recent times, the LA riots. They began when about 24 cops retreated before an angry crowd after the Rodney King verdicts, some of them literally running away. The mob descended on the intersection of Florence and Normandy and began beating Anglo and Latino motorists, completely unmolested by the authorities for hours. Some police reported being ordered to leave the area and then being ordered not to return. A couple of squad cars drove through the intersection without stopping. The rest is history. Days of violence, more than 60 people killed and 2,000 injured, and in excess of $1 billion in property damage. By the end, thousands of federal troops were in the city. Back in 1970, in his classic book on domestic unrest, The Riot Makers, Eugene Methvin identified police absence or pullback as the accelerant on riots. It was a huge factor in the Watts riots in 1965. The same dynamic held in Philadelphia riot the year before. An officer there expressed exactly the same sentiment as a retreating LAPD officer in 1992. The hell with it. Let them do what they want. In Detroit in 1967, cops retreated, and the authorities underestimated the forces they needed as a riot devastated the city. It is simply not true that rioters will be quickly sated if they are allowed to break and burn things easily. Disorder feeds on itself. Looting one store, overturning one police car is never enough. There is no alternative to imposing curfews. Zealously enforcing them, arresting violators, and calling out the National Guard if there's not a police manpower for this job. This doesn't escalate the violence, it stops it. Over the weekend, Minneapolis finally got serious about policing itself and saw a drastic diminishment of destruction. Anyone who doesn't want American cities to burn should take note. This column is entitled Guest View. Guns are brought to peaceful rallies to intimidate, threaten, from the Houston Chronicle. Government-ordered closings and personal restrictions decreed in Texas and around the nation to battle the new coronavirus pandemic over the past 2 months have sparked acts of civil disobedience and perfectly legal protests. Cries of oppression and tyranny may seem a bit overblown when it comes to issues regarding access to bars, gyms, and hair salons, but the frustration is understandable. We should never grow blasé about the threat of government overreach or abuse of power. The Constitution does promise the right of the people peacefully to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. The problem comes when these supposed peaceful assemblies are wreathed by men carrying rifles prominently slung on their shoulders or at their waists. The military-style firepower is often made more ominous by the fact that the civilian rifleman is wearing camouflage, a flak jacket, or other type of body armor. Such menacing displays are clearly meant to intimidate and threaten, and have no place at a peaceful demonstration or rally. It threatens our democracy and the Constitution many of the gun-toting protesters claim to revere. Make all the signs you want, wave all the flags you can get your hands on, and shout your objections and slogans to the high heavens. But to paraphrase Johnny Cash, don't take your guns to the rally. It's about the right to free speech, yours and others. The presence of at-the-ready firearms has a way of stifling that discourse, not to mention heightening the risk of armed confrontation that could end up with a lot of people, including unarmed bystanders, dead or wounded. One of the scariest situations came in early May when armed protesters made their way inside the Michigan Capitol, pushing face-to-face confrontations with police and occupying the Senate gallery where they stood, weapons at their side, above the lawmakers. It was all legal, but always just one misstep away from setting off a deadly riot that could have spread well beyond the Michigan State House. Those with guns were not there, quote, to petition the government for a redress of grievances, unquote. They were there to incite fear and subvert the democratic process through a show of force. That is not how things should happen in this country. A similar event happened less than a week later in Odessa when six men with loaded AR-15-type weapons showed up to help a bar owner reopen her business against a state order by Governor Greg Abbott. The men were arrested for possessing firearms on a property licensed to serve alcohol. Hector County Sheriff Mike Griffiths said, making it clear at a press conference that he is as pro-gun rights and as anti-government intrusion as anyone in Texas. We're not here to violate anybody's Second Amendment rights, Griffiths said. I've been saying it for years, and people will tell you. All the good citizens need to arm themselves because all the bad citizens already have. I believe that. Griffin noted that he doesn't agree with some of the closure orders. But why do you want to use intimidation as a way to keep law enforcement from doing what we're supposed to do? If you don't like it, run for governor. The sheriff's empathetic stand didn't shield his office from threats or complaints that the Second Amendment had been violated. But even the state's notoriously lax gun laws do include common sense restrictions on bringing firearms to bars. Texas is one of 44 states that allow rifles to be carried pretty much anywhere else in public, which may have deterred a crackdown at demonstrations so far. But state law does prohibit the display of a firearm or other deadly weapon in a public place in a manner calculated to alarm. What other calculation could there be for bringing a lethal weapon to a public demonstration except to alarm and intimidate? Leave the guns at home. This column is entitled SpaceX is a Testament to Free Enterprise by Mark Thiessen, Washington Post Writers Group. It was one small step for man, one giant leap for capitalism. Only three countries have ever reached human beings into orbit. have ever launched human beings into orbit. This past weekend, SpaceX became the first private company ever to do so, when it sent its Crew Dragon capsule into space aboard its Falcon 9 rocket and docked with the International Space Station. This was accomplished by a company Elon Musk started in 2002 in a California strip mall warehouse with just a dozen employees and a mariachi band. At a time when our nation is debating the merits of socialism, SpaceX has given us an incredible testament to the power of American free enterprise. While the left is advocating unprecedented government intervention in almost every sector of the U.S. economy, from healthcare to energy, today Americans are celebrating the successful privatization of space travel. If you want to see the difference between what government and private enterprise can do, consider. It took a private company to give us the first space vehicle with touchscreen controls instead of antiquated knobs and buttons. It took a private company to give us a capsule that can fly entirely autonomously from launch to landing, including docking, without any participation by its human crew. It also took a private company to invent a reusable rocket that can not only take off, but land as well. When the Apollo 11 crew reached the moon on July 20, 1969, Neil Armstrong declared, "The Eagle has landed." On Saturday, SpaceX was able to declare that the Falcon had landed when its rocket settled down on a barge in the Atlantic Ocean, ready to be used again. That last development will save the taxpayers incredible amounts of money. The cost to NASA for launching a man into space on the Space Shuttle Orbiter was $170 million per seat, compared with just $60 to $67 million on the Dragon capsule. The cost for the Space Shuttle to send a kilogram of cargo into space was $54,500. With the Falcon rocket, the cost is just $2,720, a decrease of 95%. And while the Space Shuttle cost $27.4 billion to develop, the Crew Dragon was designed and built for just $1.7 billion, making it the lowest-cost spacecraft developed in 6 decades. SpaceX did it in 6 years, far faster than the time it took to develop the Space Shuttle. The private sector does it better, cheaper, faster, and more efficiently than government. Why? Competition. Today, SpaceX has to compete with a constellation of private companies, including legacy aerospace firms such as Orbital ATK and United Launch Alliance, and innovative startups such as Blue Origin, which is designing a Mars lander and whose owner, Jeff Bezos, also owns the Washington Post, and Virgin Orbit, which is developing rockets that can launch satellites into space from the underside of a 747. Avoiding the kinds of weather that delayed the Dragon launch. In the race to put the first privately launched man into orbit, upstart SpaceX had to beat aerospace behemoth Boeing and its Starliner capsule to the punch. It did so for more than $1 billion less than its competitor. That spirit of competition and innovation will revolutionize space travel in the years ahead. Indeed, Musk has his sights set far beyond Earth orbit. Already, SpaceX is working on a much larger version of the Falcon 9 reusable rocket called Super Heavy that will carry a deep space capsule named Starship capable of carrying up to 100 people to the moon and eventually to Mars. Musk's goal, the reason he founded SpaceX, is to colonize Mars and make a humanity with multiplanetary species. He has set a goal of founding a 1-million-person city on Mars by 2050, complete with iron foundries and pizza joints. Can it be done? Who knows? But this much is certain. Private sector innovation is opening the door to a new era of space exploration. Wouldn't it be ironic if, just as capitalism is allowing us to explore the farthest reaches of our solar system, Americans decided to embrace socialism back here on Earth? This is the obituary column for Wednesday, June 3rd, 2020. George Watt III. On November 6, 1947, a beautiful baby boy was born in Big Spring, Texas. A selfless woman placed that baby into the loving arms of Fred and Verdell Watt. They named that beautiful baby boy George Frederick Freddie Watt III. Freddie is preceded in death by his maternal and paternal grandparents, Fred and Verdell Watt, aunt and uncle Shorty and Dodie Hall, cousins LaRue Tucker, James Sims, Don Hall, Barbara Hall, Rogene Spruill, father-in-law Pete Mills, his many fur babies, especially Gracie Jean, his sidekick for many years. Freddie is survived by his wife of 44 years, Tammy, his son Brian and wife Natalie, grandson Braden, and granddaughter Briley, all of Midland. His fur babies, Sophie and Radar. He is survived by many cousins, his mother-in-law, Rose Mills, brother-in-law, David Eberly, and wife, Nancy, and their children, Tyler and Evan of Midland, Lacey Rogers, husband Kevin, and their children, Callie and Leah of Rockwell, sister-in-law Kim Howell and husband Roger and their children, Link Lawrence, Cohen and Libby Lawrence, and Scout, all of Eastland, brother-in-law Jason Eberly, wife Amy and children, Tyler, Jackson, and Morgan of Graham, as well as many, many other long-term friends. Special thanks to Nancy Barrio, Martha Ramirez and Cassie Kirkpatrick and Hospice of Midland for the amazing job they did making Freddie's final days comfortable. In lieu of flowers, memorials can be directed to Hospice of Midland, 911 West Texas Avenue, Midland, Texas, High Sky Children's Ranch, 8613 West County Road 60 of Midland, Texas, or Fannin Terrace Baptist Church, 28 Mogford Street, Midland, Texas. Memorial services will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, June 6th at Fannin Terrace Baptist Church in Midland. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Picklin Wells Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelsh.com. Walter E. Dub Brown. Walter E. Dub Brown, 67, of Midland, Texas, passed away on Saturday, May 30th, 2020. He was born on July 22, 1952, in Lindsay, Oklahoma, to Walter W. and Ada Lee Brown. He is survived by his wife, Leanne Brown, daughter, Danielle, and her husband, Junior Olivas of Midland, Texas, son, Shane Brown, and wife, Lisa of Odessa, Texas, grandchildren, Kylie Olivas, Shelby Olivas, and Aaron Smith, and wife, Mitzi of Midland, Texas, Brazos and husband Evan Gonzalez of Odessa, Texas, Brady Smith of Lubbock, Texas, five great-grandchildren, sister Sherry and husband Tommy Weaver of Albuquerque, New Mexico, brother Randy Brown of Lindsay, Oklahoma, and many beloved nieces and nephews. He is preceded in death by his parents Walter W. and Ada Lee Brown, niece Natalie Weaver Weitzel, and nephew Jonathan Rambo Brown. A memorial service is planned for Friday, June 5, 2020, at Nally Picklin Wells Funeral Home Chapel, 3800 North Big Spring Street in Midland at 2 p.m. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Picklin Wells Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelsh.com. Federico Freddy Flores. Federico Freddy Flores, 69, of Midland, passed away Monday, June 1, 2020. Viewing will be at Wednesday and Thursday at Heavenly Gate Funeral Home. A funeral mass is set for Friday, June 8, 2020, at 10 a.m. at San Miguel Arcangel Catholic Church. Burial will follow at Serenity Memorial Gardens. He is survived by his wife, Guadalupe Lupe Flores, daughter Magda Flores, two sons, Freddy Flores Jr. and Moises Jaime Flores, his mother Pilar S. Hull, one brother, four sisters, and five grandchildren. Patsy Dillard, 75, of Midland, passed away May 31st, 2020. Services are pending with Nally Picklin Wells Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Thomas Charles Carlisle. Thomas Charles Carlyle, 74, passed away May 31, 2020 in Odessa, Texas. Thomas was born on December 12, 1945 to Lois and Robert Carlyle in Odessa, Texas. No services have been scheduled at this time. Arrangements by American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home, Crematory. This is the oil and gas page. This article is entitled Oil and Gas Leave New Mexico's Budget Woes by Adrian Hedden, Carlsbad Current Argus. Declines in oil and gas revenue brought on by shrinking fuel demand brought on by the COVID-19 pandemic led New Mexico to lose an estimated up to $2 billion budget surplus reported last year, instead suffering up to $2.8 billion deficit. The budget woes prompted Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham to call a special legislative session for lawmakers to address how the state would prepare for next year's general session while remaining financially stable. Lujan Grisham announced last week that the special session would start on June 18th, a Thursday, and continue through the weekend. She said federal stimulus money and reserves in state coffers could provide some relief, but lawmakers would still need to adjust the budget to account for less revenue. We are working with the leadership in the House and the Senate to make sure we have a productive session, which is about making sure that any changes to the current fiscal year get addressed to make sure the state stays in the black, Lujan Grisham said. A budget deficit was looming for the 2020 legislative session, Lujan Grisham said, which could be as high as $2.8 billion. I don't want to diminish that we are in an economic crisis, she said, but make sure that we are in the possible position for the 2021 session. A May 22nd report from the Legislative Finance Committee said general fund recurring figures for fiscal year 2020 through February were about $5 billion, down $157 million, or 3%, from the same time period last year. Mineral production taxes post a revenue decline as of February of almost $40 million when compared with last year, read the report, down to about $4 million from $43.7 million in February 2019. Rents and royalties, which oil and gas companies pay to the state for land minerals, are produced on, also saw a drop from $90 million in February 2019 to about $82 million this year. Year-to-date revenue through February for rents and royalties was down about $393 million, the report read, from about $1.04 billion to $640 million, a 37.8% drop. Revenue from New Mexico's corporate income tax saw the biggest drop, the report read, down about $87 million from $88.6 million for the fiscal year 2019 through February of last year, to about $1.6 million for the same time frame this year. License fees declined by 78.6% from $27.7 million for fiscal year 2019 as of February of that year to $5.9 million this year. The report warned of continued declines in the price per barrel of crude oil due to the pandemic impacting state revenue. Domestic crude fell to about $40 per barrel in April and showed some recovery in May to about $33 per barrel as of Friday, per data from NASDAQ. Further threatening a downward trend in oil was continued increases in production during the early months of the year, as New Mexico's oil production was up about 28% in February compared with the same last year. Oil prices collapsed in the following months, initiated by an oil price war between Saudi Arabia and Russia, and exacerbated by falling demand as state and nations around the world issued stay-at-home orders to combat the novel coronavirus, the report read. Oil production in fiscal year 20 through February is up about 28% with the same period a year ago. However, extremely low oil prices is causing widespread shutdown of non-economical wells, which is expected to lead to production declines in the following months. New Mexico Representative Jim Townsend, R54 of Artesia, said the budget will be the main focus of the special session, as the current fiscal year was predicted to be $400 million under budget, and Lujan Grisham was hoping to use about $800 million in federal stimulus funds to make up the difference. But Townsend worried the federal funding might not be available for balancing state budgets, but for direct COVID-19 relief, which he said might be better spent supporting small businesses crippled by the pandemic. A lot of how we balance the budget will depend on how willing our governor is to have anything and everything on the table, Townsend said. It will also depend on how much leeway the federal government will give us in using CARES Act dollars. Townsend said he was slightly emboldened by the apparent rebound in oil prices, but still worried New Mexico's economy was suffering under declining gross receipts, taxes, and might need to pull back on spending initiatives from last year's session. He reported to a $325 million program for universal child care and $150 million per year in film subsidies that could be on the chopping block, along with curbing dramatic recent growth in several state agencies. It was just a perfect storm, Townsend said. We spent too much last year. We had COVID. We had oil and gas. All that our budget is in a tailspin. Distributed by Tribune Content Agency. This article is entitled, Shale is Bouncing Back at a Time with Oil Above $30. By Kevin Crowley, David Wethy, and Haley Waller, Bloomberg. Early signs of a shale rebound are becoming evident as crude prices emerge from their dramatic collapse earlier this year. EOG Resources Inc., America's largest shale-focused producer, plans to accelerate output in the second half after shutting in about a quarter of its crude in May. Exploration Chief Ken Bodecker told an RBC Capital Markets conference Tuesday. Permian producer Parsley Energy Inc. is also turning wells back on just weeks after closing the taps, and producers in North Dakota's Bakken Formation are also easing the rate of shut-ins. Oil has steadily gained in the past month after virus-related lockdowns caused the price of West Texas Intermediate to collapse to minus $40 a barrel on April 20th, while the U.S. benchmark is still about 40% below its January high point. It's now above $35, which means some wells closed to save cash are now profitable again. West Texas Intermediate for July rose $1.37 to settle at $36.81 a barrel. Brent for August delivery rose $1.25 to $39.57. When oil gets back into the mid-30s, you're covering your cash costs, said Stuart Glickman, energy analyst at CRFA Research. You're closer to some break-even point. That's enough to relax the shut-ins. Still, the big question is whether bringing this output back will be enough to offset the lack of new drilling, which is essential to mitigate the industry's dramatic decline rates. Led by shale, U.S. oil production has dropped about 13% from a record high of 13.1 million barrels a day in March. EOG's strategy is to really accelerate our production into what we see as a price recovery in the second half of the year, Bodecker said. The company, which began shutting wells in March and took 125,000 barrels a day off the market in May, recently reduced its hedge position, eliminating some protection against lower prices in a sign of confidence that the price recovery will take hold. Parsley will store the vast majority of the 26,000 barrels of daily output it turned off last month, it said in a slide deck for an investor presentation. Meanwhile, shut-ins in the Bakken totaled 475,000 barrels a day as of May 28th, about 7% less than a fortnight earlier. The number of frac crews working in shale fields is believed to have now bottomed at about 80 fleets, with noticeably higher completion work in the next 3 to 6 months. Daniel Cruz, founder of data provider Chorus Research LLC, said last week in a report. Based on current budget tweaks announced by explorers, many as 50 frac crews could still be added by the end of the year, with that number doubling if oil prices move closer to $40 a barrel, according to Coris. EOG's optimism is due in part to the woes that lie ahead for the rest of the U.S. shale industry. Companies will struggle to find money to drill new wells, meaning less oil over the short term to medium term, Bodecker said. We see very little capital flowing into the industry, and we see higher declines from all the shale players throughout the rest of the year, he said. Starting to drill in the high 30s? I'm not sure I see that. The data appears to support his view. Drill rigs carving new wells in the U.S. have dropped to the lowest in more than a decade, and producers' spending in the second quarter is expected to be 60% down on the first 3 months of the year, according to data provider Chorus Research LLC. We are not putting new capital to work, Parsley Chief Executive Officer Matt Gallagher said by email. Our drilling and frack operations remain suspended as we evaluate market fundamentals.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.